It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new report tracks the impact of gerrymandered district lines around the country and what happens when independent commissions draw the lines instead of elected officials. We'll get the details and you can join in with your thoughts and questions. First, candidates in some of this year's midterm races around the country are agreeing to fewer debates than usual or opting out of them altogether. That's true in Wisconsin, too, with a general election debate season that's shaping up to be slower than usual. Republican challenger Tim Michaels and Democratic Governor Tony Evers recently announced they'll hold one debate before Election Day in November. In the U.S. Senate race so far, Republican Senator Ron Johnson has accepted three invitations. His Democratic challenger, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, so far has only accepted one. Our next guest says we lose something when candidates cut back on debates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a voter, as a citizen, does this matter to you? Do you want to see candidates debate more? Candidates including Wisconsin's race for governor or U.S. Senate, for example, are debates valuable to you as a voter? What would you change about the way we do debates with political candidates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Diana Carlin is Professor Emerita of Communications at St. Louis University. She's studied political debates for over four decades and is the author of multiple books on the topic, including the 1992 Presidential Debates in Focus. Diana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
We're seeing reports from all over the country where it seems like, you know, debates aren't going to be non-existent, but they are fewer and further between than usual. What is your reaction as we get closer to Election Day?
Well, I'm disappointed. You know, as a voter, I want to hear the debates, and I think the public deserves to have them. I've always viewed the debates as a job interview, and it's just like asking people to hire you without going through the interview.
What do you think is driving candidates to maybe be more reluctant to debate?
All of the reasons why they are good are probably the reasons. They reach more people in an unfiltered way. They get into issues in more depth than a 30-second spot or a piece of direct mail or a robocall. You can get nailed by your opponent or by a question. They come with a high amount of risk. And we have a lot of very, very close races around the country at many levels. And especially incumbents. Incumbents are always reluctant to debate. And I know I live in Kansas now, and our incumbent Republican senator is refusing to debate the challenger. And there are fewer debates on the other levels, too. So it is across the country, as your introduction said. But the high risk, the fact that if you do make a mistake, it gets played over and over. And with social media, some of this gets retweeted. All of those are reasons why I think people are refusing to do it.
Now, if I'm a candidate in 2022, and I'm not for good reason, but if I am, I have a lot of ways to get, use the word unfiltered, I have a lot of ways to get filtered messages out to people. There's social media, as you mentioned. There's the old broadcast ads, YouTube ads, streaming ads, whatever. There are probably friendly media sources I know I can go to and say what I want to say. How do we overcome, I guess, the incentive structure to go to these controlled forms of outreach as opposed to these more risky forms of outreach for a candidate?
I think there are some ways to get around it so that people are more encouraged to debate. I mean, this is part of the thing, is how the debates are done often is what causes candidates to not want to participate. So the negotiation part is very important, to where people think it's fair. There aren't going to be the gotcha kinds of questions. You know, one of the reasons that the Commission on Presidential Debates went to a single moderator was that it reduced the risk for people to try to show off. If you had three people up there on the stage or four, think about the primary debates. They all want to be the one to ask the gotcha questions. And so they often don't concentrate on major issues. But for instance, have a single moderator, you tell them these are the four issues we're going to talk about, and they have somebody who they really trust, that you're going to have questions from the audience, you know, whatever. If it's outlined and it looks like it has less risk, you might get people to participate more.
in our current political climate, it seems like it's hard to get two parties or two candidates to agree on one person that they're going to agree is fair and non-biased. Do you see that as part of the challenge?
It is part of the challenge. And once again, you can see that with the presidential debates. Everybody has some complaint about whomever they select. Jim Lehrer was considered really the poster child for how to do this in a way that was even-handed. And that's why he did it and was the only one we had for years and years and years. And as soon as people thought that he was had maybe stepped over that line a little bit, then there were the complaints and you began seeing a different moderator for each of the debates. But, you know, I've actually negotiated some of these in the past and have advise groups that are putting them on locally or in the state. And I think you can find people who are considered honest brokers. And that's, you know, the challenge to the sponsoring agency or the network to do that. But it's, you know, I think you have a greater chance of having a debate if you have an open seat or if you have a vulnerable incumbent who feels like they have to debate to show that they, you know, what they've done, they have a better chance of doing that. They can directly answer what the opponent is saying. So the incumbency factor also filters in as well as whether it's a vulnerable candidate or not.
Talking to Diana Carlin from St. Louis University, expert on political debates over the last bunch of decades, looking at an apparent decline in the number of debates happening in big races in this year's midterm election. Often the number is one. Or sometimes zero. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see value in getting candidates for high-profile offices in particular up in front of the cameras at the same time, the same venue, debating one way or another the big issues? Do you think it's a waste of time? Do you worry about how debates are done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Diana, we heard from Paul on Facebook who says debates can be entertaining, but quoting here, by and large, there doesn't seem to be anyone changing who they're voting for based on debates. And Paul goes on, it's just about motivating marginal and occasional voters and clips for political advertising. So Paul not seeing a lot of value, I guess, Diana.
Well, a lot of people say that, but one of the points I always make when they say it doesn't change minds is that part of what motivates people to vote is if they have confidence in the person for whom they're voting. And what my research over all these years has shown and that of others is that it's just as important to solidify a vote, because then you're more motivated to actually vote. You see the person and you compare it to the person on the same stage. And then it's like, yeah, I really do need to go out and vote. Oftentimes it is those margins. Look at how many close races we have. And we've certainly had debates that have turned the tide. I can remember one, it was in one of my very first years of being eligible to vote, living in the state of Kansas. We had, open seat, and one of the candidates was not very well known. The other one was incredibly well known and was way ahead in the polls. And they had a couple televised debates. This was back when there were far fewer networks, but the newspapers carried it. It completely flipped that race. And that was because suddenly people saw the vulnerabilities of this person who'd just been in the news a lot. And the lesser known candidate suddenly is like, this is the voice of reason. And so it completely changed the dynamic of the race. And that's one of the things where I think the media is important. You know, there have been times when the media has had an empty chair. There have been several empty chair debates. In 1980, Jimmy Carter refused to show up for a three-way debate, and they had a two-way debate. And he got beat up by two people and wasn't there to defend himself with Reagan and John Anderson. But, you know, everything that I have heard, both at, you know, looking at state level and especially at national level, is that even if you change in a close race or get an undecided voter to decide, the debate can make a difference. And if it motivates people to go out and vote, especially in a lackluster campaign where people aren't too excited, yeah, I'm going to probably vote for this person, but this motivates them to do it, they can make a difference.
And Brad on Facebook says, let's have true debate where there is one topic resolved and make the candidates stick to that topic. Brad says they might even have to do some work to defend their position. And yeah, Diana, I think most of the debates I could think of are we're covering as many topics as we can fit in. What do you think of that idea, whether it's a formal debate structure, sticking with one topic for debates?
I like it. And in fact, it's been something that I have proposed. I think one of the best debates ever was one in 1948, a radio debate in a primary, which changed the outcome of the Republican primary, the Dewey-Stassen debate. And they had one topic, and that was that communism should be outlawed. But it was broadcast nationwide. Up to that point, Stassen was clearly winning the Republican nomination, and it totally flipped that one. And Thomas Dewey, you know, became the nominee. And of course, according to some paper, you know, beat Truman. but it is something that I have recommended. And once again, it's something that at the presidential level has changed, where it used to be a free for all. But now they announce ahead of time that there will be like four major topics. And I agree with that comment that we need fewer topics in more depth. But then, of course, you have to have more than one debate in order to give people the information on what might be of greater interest to them.
We're talking to Diana Carlin, professor emerita of communications at St. Louis University. She studied political debates over the decades, and we're talking to her about a lack of political debates in a lot of this year's midterms, ranging in many cases from zero to one debate, even in high-profile races. What we lose, she says, when candidates don't debate and debate often. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Do you want to see more debates? Do you see a value in them? How should they work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the role of political debates in elections, and this year's elections in particular, and why a lot of candidates are doing fewer debates, in some cases zero debates, during this year's midterms. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own ideas to make candidate debates work better. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking the call. I just wondered if the guest could comment on this being a sign of or gradual approach to authoritarianism and belief in kind of an idolatry toward one particular personality.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Diana, do you see a lack of debate as, I guess, a step away from democracy in some form?
Yeah, I think it is. I've spent a lot of time in new democracies over the years, going in on non-governmental organizations or with the State Department to take political debates into those democracies because they saw them as a starting point, that you suddenly now are being transparent and people can look side by side and make the comparisons themselves based on what the two candidates or in these other countries, multiple candidates have said. And if we don't have that, then we have lost some of the transparency. We have lost the opportunity for ourselves to compare what's being said, as opposed to what parts of it were being fed by the media or by the candidates themselves. And I just think in an open society, in a democratic society, that debate is a fundamental part of what that is. And by not having them, I agree, we are losing something.
Thanks for that call. Let's go next to Joe in Milwaukee. Joe, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I've been kind of following the flow here. I agree with the last several callers. We really need to have mono subject debates, you know, one subject examined thoroughly. That's going to force the issue of letting the American people know just how informed their candidates are. And kind of put them on the spot, as it were. I mean, I hate putting people on the spot, but in this day and age, you know, when facts don't actually matter anymore to a large percentage of the population, I think it's important, one, just to raise some of these issues and let people see that there are other perspectives on these issues other than what they get from Facebook and Tinder. And also, it forces the issue of showing what the candidate as an individual actually knows about any given subject. And you could have a series of these. I mean, I would start with democracy in America and the rule of law and kind of go from there. I mean, you could have all kinds of different subjects. You could talk about any of the different amendments to the Constitution and, get them talking about each one and what it means. I think it's a terrific idea, and I think it's an idea that we need now more than ever.
Joe, thanks for the call. Diana, no major argument from you, I'm guessing?
No, I would agree. And if you stop and think about whether it's a Senate race, a House race, a governor's race, attorney general, whatever, it really does come down to two or three top issues. And polling data helps us know what's on the public's mind and what's been in the news. And so it's not that difficult to narrow this down to two or three topics. The problem, I agree with the caller, it would be nice to have a series of two or three debates that get at the top topics. It's hard to get the candidates to even agree to one. But even if you could have a debate that's centered on the top two issues that, the public polling is showing are on people's minds, because those often relate to other issues. So if, one of it is the economy, and they're looking at jobs. Well, when you're talking about jobs, then you're also talking about what that impact is going to be on the education system. So it allows them to show their breadth of knowledge. I agree with the caller completely that we need some focus, and a debate can do that and can get you the depth.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Joan with us in Sauk City. Joan, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Joan?
Well, I do think the debates are important. It shows the depth of knowledge of the candidates on the issues that are of interest to us. It also shows their personality and their respondents to something that may irritate them in some ways. But, otherwise all we get is what they want to tell us on the news and in what we read and get through our mail, instead of actually seeing their opinions on topics that they may not have sent out to us through their ads.
Joan, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Diana, again, this the opportunity to see those unfiltered candidates. Joan likes that.
Yes, and Joan, I think you're right on target. These are individuals who want to be public officials. They're going to be subjected to questions they don't like from the media if they're elected. They have it on the campaign trail. And to shy away from facing the voters who are hiring them really says something, too, about the character. And I know candidates who want debates often play up that point. Historically, there's a great example of it back in 1992. President George H.W. Bush hated debates, and he thought he could negotiate his way out of the three debates that were being proposed. So he kept dragging out the negotiations, and the first debate date came along, and he wasn't there, and Clinton had a big rally, and then Perot got in, and then they finally got the debates. But before Bush finally agreed to go back to the negotiating table, there was a guy who was following him around in a chicken suit. Older people will remember this one, with a sign that said, Chicken George won't debate. And that got incredible attention. Comments were made about it. Why is he afraid to get on a stage? And that helped get him back to the negotiating table. So candidates who want to debate and aren't have some opportunities to really comment on their opponent and their opponent's unwillingness. And why are they afraid to face the people and answer questions? So I think whatever the public can do, whatever the media can do, again, to point out that people are sort of hiding from what some of us consider, and your callers have an obligation to present their side and be compared directly with their opponent.
Thanks for the call, Joan. Faith joins us next in Madison. Faith, hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for this topic and the program. I guess I have a couple questions. One is, I'm wondering who is in charge of making the decisions about what ultimately happens in a debate, And why can't we expect more of people running for office? I mean, even entry-level jobs have higher requirements, it seems, in many cases, for what people need to go through in order to be considered for a position. And these are very high-level positions. So I don't understand why we can't expect more of the people who are running and insist that they, you know, if they're not going to participate in a debate, then they're not going to run.
Faith, thanks for the call. Diana, to Faith's first point, who tends to be the outfit, the organization setting up these debates in the first place?
Well, that sort of depends on where you are. Some of them are media outlets. So if they're televised in a studio, it would be one of the networks, possibly public broadcasting has often done those. Some of the time, the League of Women Voters puts them on. They were the first ones to ever put on debates. And they were doing it right after they were formed, after the 19th Amendment in 2020. So they've been in that business a long time. Some of the time, it's other types of organizations that do it. So it's a variety, and they are the ones who try to get the candidates' staffs together and negotiate something that they can both live with. State fairs often have debates. We just had a debate at the Kansas State Fair a couple weeks ago with our gubernatorial candidates. The Senate debate did not happen. So, in various states and cities and even in the country, in the U.S., the Commission on Presidential Debates has been around since the 88 election, and they're the ones who do the general election debates. The primary debates are all done by the networks. And if you notice the difference between the primary debates for president and the general election, the primary debates have advertising. These are money makers for them, and that's part of why they aren't useful, like one of our early callers said, because they're all out there for the gotcha questions and the ratings. The general election debates are paid for privately. They're all done through a 501, a nonprofit, and it's all money that's been contributed, and there are no ads. So they are not commercials. They are not a moneymaker for anyone.
Diana, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Oh, you are very welcome.
That's Diana Carlin, debate expert at St. Louis University, looking at a decline in the number of political debates apparently this year around the country. Coming up, a look at gerrymandering and competitive congressional seats. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Midwest's largest Viking festival is coming to Green Bay this weekend. We'll talk to one of the organizers about Scandinavian culture here in Wisconsin. Now, it's election season in the state and around the U.S., and according to a new report on congressional and state district boundaries, quote, America's approach to districting is both unique and, by the standards of modern democracy, uniquely awful. Why? Two things. One of them is gerrymandering, according to the report. The other, a fundamental decision in how we represent ourselves in legislatures. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how we got to where we are today with state and federal legislative maps? How worried are you about partisan gerrymandering around the country, here in Wisconsin in particular? Are there changes you'd like to see? Do you want to see Wisconsin, for example, go to some kind of independent commission to draw those lines in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow in the political reform program at New America. He's author of Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America, lecturer at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Advanced Governmental Studies, and co-host of the podcast Politics in Question. His recent report for New America is called What We Know About Redistricting and Redistricting Reform. Lee, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it is a great delight to be talking about this crucial topic with you at this crucial time in our nation's history.
There's a two-part problem as I read the report. Let's start with the one you spend the most time on and the one that I think is most familiar for people, gerrymandering, the idea of partisan line drawing for our congressional seats. In your report, you say it's got a long history in America, but in some ways it's particularly bad now. Why is that?
Well, it is particularly bad now because the stakes of our elections are so high and our parties are so evenly balanced that if one party gets a hold on the state legislature and uses that hold to give itself a few extra congressional seats or a few extra seats in the state legislature, it gets a boost that allows it to get 100% of the power in the Congress or in the state legislature with a very narrow majority. And you know, when we have this moment of close elections and extreme hyper-partisanship, every little advantage is just incredibly important and incredibly consequential.
The other part of this report that I think people might take for granted is the way we elect people to Congress or the legislature, single representative districts where this chunk of real estate elects one member of Congress, that chunk over there does another one. This is just how we've all voted probably for our entire lives if we lived in the U.S. Why do you see that as a fundamental problem?
Well, the problem is that it's the single member district that makes gerrymandering possible. Matt, imagine if there was one statewide district in Wisconsin and all representatives were elected proportionally from that statewide district. Would you be able to gerrymander it? Nope. So really, you can only do gerrymandering with single member districts because this gives you many different options of ways that you can draw district lines and push the other party's voters into just a few districts and spread your voters more equally across all districts. But take that possibility away and you don't have gerrymandering anymore. Now, the U.S. is just one of really a handful of advanced democracies that still uses what I would consider to be a very antiquated system of single member districts. It doesn't make any sense. The second district of Wisconsin is not an organic community. It's an artificially drawn community. I think, unless maybe I don't know something about the second district of Wisconsin that you know.
Right. And that takes us back to gerrymandering and how those lines with single member districts are drawn. Can you talk about some of the tactics you looked at in the report that, say, a state legislature might use to pack, say, a lot of Democratic voters into a second district or Republican voters in another state into another district?
Well, the basic game with gerrymandering and districting more broadly is that it matters very much where voters live. So ideally, you'd pack all of your opposing party's votes into just a few districts and spread, or basically as many as you can, and then spread your voters out more equally. This is possible, again, with single member districts, but the idea is that it's not so much how many voters you have statewide, but rather what the balance is in each district. So this is the classic technique. Distribute your voters more efficiently so you win more districts, and distribute your opponent's voters less efficiently, so they are all concentrated in a handful of districts. Now, the reality of our politics is that Democrats mostly live in the cities. In Wisconsin, for example, you have two cities that are predominantly Democratic, and the rest of the state, not so much. This is not unique to Wisconsin, but what it means is that Republicans have a kind of natural advantage just by being the party of the countryside and smaller towns, and Democrats have a natural disadvantage by being the party of cities because they naturally concentrate more of their voters. It also means that it's not really gerrymandering that's causing the decline in congressional districts that are competitive. It's geographic sorting. If Republicans and Democrats live in very different places, it's just really hard to draw competitive districts. And I think this is really important because we often blame gerrymandering for extremism and for everything that's gone wrong with our politics. But the problem is that it's not just, although gerrymandering does make it worse, when you have single member districts in which you can only have one winner, Democrats stop competing for districts that are outside of the major cities, and Republicans stop competing for districts that are in the major cities, and you wind up with this bifurcated binary system in which the two parties just don't really compete against each other.
Talking to Lee Drutman from the group New America. He's the author of a new report called What We Know About Redistricting and Redistricting Reform. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. In just a few moments, we'll look at independent commissions in some states, whether they make a difference. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brad is with us in Jefferson. Brad, hi.
Hi there. I think that Wisconsin is gerrymandered so badly, the Republicans don't really need to listen to the people because they don't need the people's support. They've got power, and a lot of that comes from big business money. But it ends up being that the Republicans then ignore the will of the people. You see that in this referendum that Evers is talking about right now.
Brad, thanks for that call. Lee, do you agree with Brad that the two distortions you talk about, gerrymandering and sort of the geographic way we do districts, ends up allowing a party in power to ignore the public will, as Brad worries?
Well, I think what you have in Wisconsin and some other states are, Wisconsin is a 50-50 state, but the congressional maps are drawn in a way that benefits Republicans. The legislative maps have been terribly gerrymandered. So Republicans pay attention to their voters. Democrats pay attention to their voters. Now, I think one of the challenges in this particular political moment that we're in which the parties are extremely polarized, is that there is no single will of the people. There's a Democratic vision for the state and for the country. There's a Republican vision for the state or the country. And to think that, well, if only the districts were drawn more fairly, the will of the people would be represented, ignores this deep level of polarization that is a product of the urban-rural split in our politics, refracted through single-member districts in the two-party system. So while gerrymandering has obviously given Republicans an advantage in the state of Wisconsin, the deeper problem is also the way in which it reinforces this polarization, which makes it hard to agree on anything. So there is no real sense of what do the people want, because there's Republican people and Democratic people in our politics right now.
Brad, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Lee, in your new report, you look at the states that have come up with some kind of alternative to having, you know, state legislatures draw these lines. What, if any, kind of impact did that end up having?
So there are a couple of states that have moved to independent citizen commissions, which are really, truly independent from the state legislatures. And it seems as if California, Colorado, Michigan, these are states that have done this, have produced maps that are at least fairer to both parties. So the balance of representation is roughly equal to the party's vote share across the state. However, they haven't produced that many competitive districts because of the problem that I mentioned earlier, which is that Republicans and Democrats just live in very different places, so it's very hard to draw competitive districts. So independent redistricting commissions, if they are truly independent of the state legislature, and the state legislature has no power to override them, which is the case in some states that do have commissions, but truly independent commissions do produce a modest improvement in the fairness, but they still are unable to draw very many competitive districts.
We're talking to Lee Drutman, senior fellow in the political reform program at the organization New America, about his report, What We Know About Redistricting and Redistricting Reform. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a change in how Wisconsin draws its political maps for members of the U.S. House of Representatives, for members of the State Assembly and Senate? Do you think it would make a difference if we had some kind of independent system instead of having whoever's in charge of the state legislature do it, as filtered ultimately through the courts in many cases? And what about the urban-rural divide between parties? Do you think there's a way to get a more representative, whatever that might mean, outcomes in elections? What do you think of the idea of something like, hey, the whole state votes for Congress and proportional representation determines how many members from each party go to Washington? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with senior fellow Lee Drutman from the group New America, looking at his recent report on redistricting and redistricting reform. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think gerrymandering, partisan ways to draw these lines for legislatures here in Wisconsin and nationally, are a problem? If so, what would you like to see as a solution? Do you have questions for our guest about how this works around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Back to your calls. Zach is with us now in Elk Mound. Zach, hi.
Hi. I do believe the gerrymandering is a problem in Wisconsin. I'm sure other places too. I'd just like to get your guests' thoughts about ranked choice voting.
Zach, thanks for the call. Yeah, some members of the legislature from both parties have floated ideas about ranked choice voting here in Wisconsin. Lee, big in the news after the special congressional election in Alaska. Do you have thoughts on ranked choice?
I have lots of thoughts on ranked choice voting. I've done actually another report, what we know about ranked choice voting. So I think ranked choice voting is an improvement over the existing system of first-past-the-post voting. But I think it's a pretty minor improvement. I think it doesn't solve the gerrymandering problem because it doesn't address the problem of single-member districts. To me, that's the core problem, is that as long as we have single-member districts, we have the possibility of gerrymandering. And we have districts that are lopsidedly Democratic or lopsidedly Republican, so ranked choice voting won't even really matter in those elections because it's just so solidly one party or the other. Now, I could see the case for doing statewide proportional representation with ranked choice voting, and that's a system that's used to elect the Australian Senate, for example, is to have larger multi-member districts with ranked choice voting. It's also used to elect the Parliament of Ireland. So I think there's value there. But without addressing the core problem of the single member district, ranked choice voting is not going to do all that much. I think it could work well in more local elections, like city elections, which are often nonpartisan. But as far as solving the problem of gerrymandering, it's not going to solve the problem of gerrymandering.
Zach, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jimmy joins us now in Oconomowoc. Jimmy, hi.
Hi. Three words. John Wesley Powell. So John Wesley Powell is the first guy to go down the Grand Canyon. He explored and surveyed the West, and he proposed way, way back what should be our natural districting policy throughout the nation. And that, to wit, is through watersheds. Watersheds represent our primary necessity for resource management and are a natural guide to districting people together in communities that really matter to them. So that's my proposal.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Jimmy hits ultimately, Lee, I think, on one of the criteria, communities of shared interest that goes into setting district lines, at least in theory. But that's just one of, I think, five, and nobody really agrees on what all five of them mean. Can you talk about all the different things people are trying to balance?
Yeah. So the first and perhaps most central thing that people talk about is the idea of fairness to both parties, that it should be neutral, it shouldn't advantage Democrats or Republicans. And given our close two-party politics, this is obviously a central focus and something that the independent commissions can do a decent job of. Then there's the ideal of having competitive districts, which, you know, we think, well, elections should be competitive, but again, given that Democrats and Republicans live in very different places, it's very hard to draw competitive districts within the single member framework. And so now we have about 10% of districts this election that are like really competitive, which is kind of an absurd definition of democracy if we have 90% of elections in which there's no real competition. So those are the big two. Then there's the question of compactness, which is that we like districts that look compact, or at least don't spread out over too big of an area. This is a little bit more of an aesthetic choice, but I think it connects to the idea of communities of interest, which is that you should keep communities together, which gets on the question of maybe watersheds are the right community of interest. And it's a novel idea. I admit this is the first time I've heard that. But it is certainly intriguing. And then finally, a fifth criteria is the idea of being fair to racial minorities by allowing them to elect candidates who represent them. And this is the idea of majority-minority districts. And that is also a challenge within the single-member district framework, because it's not always the case that people of communities of color live in distinct areas. Sometimes they live more diffusely in a way that makes it harder to elect a majority-minority, or to have a majority-minority district. Nonetheless, that has been a way in which minority representation in Congress hasn't increased over the years. It may be harder to improve on that much now. So those are the five criteria: partisan fairness, competitiveness, compactness, keeping communities of interest together, and fair racial representation.
Thanks for that call, Lee. I want to take our last couple of minutes, since we keep running up against the problems you see with a single member district. How do we get from that to something else?
Well, the alternative of multi-member districts with proportional representation is hardly a novel idea. It is used in most advanced democracies around the world, but we have had multi-member districts at various times in our history, although they weren't proportional. So the state legislature could pass a law for its own state election. So tomorrow the Wisconsin state legislature could pass a law that state legislative elections for Wisconsin are elected through proportional multi-member districts. However, they cannot affect how the congressional delegation is elected, because Congress in 1967 passed a law requiring single member districts, the Uniform Congressional Districting Act, which was passed to prevent Southern states from moving to a system of block voting, which would have been very bad for minority representation. But ideally, Congress could pass a law that would either allow states to experiment with different forms of proportional representation by repealing the 67 prohibition on multi-member districts, and allowing states to try out different approaches as long as they're proportional, or Congress could also mandate proportional multi-member districts. And there is, in fact, a bill, the Fair Representation Act, which is sponsored by Representative Don Beyer, which would do this. But I also want to point out that I was involved in a recent scholars letter. Over 200 esteemed scholars of democracy who agree that the single member district is well past its sell-by date, and in order to have fair representation in the U.S., we need to move to proportional multi-member districts.
We'll leave it there. Lee, thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rob. I hope the beginning of a real big conversation about how we do representation in the 21st century in America.
That's Lee Drotman, Senior Fellow in the Political Reform Program at New America, looking at his new report, What We Know About Redistricting and Redistricting Reform. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Wisconsin's bow hunting season is coming up. Get a preview. Maybe join in with your questions or your experiences. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we talked about parking and the cost of free parking in some communities. As a follow-up, I have some thoughts on free parking on the Monopoly game board. You may know I'm a big fan of board games. Haven't played Monopoly in a while. There's a lot of other good games out there. But if I were to play, I would do one thing. If you're going to play Monopoly, here's my unsolicited advice. Don't do the thing where you get money when you land on the free parking spot. There's a good chance you learned to play the game, as I did, with money on free parking, with someone there to start, some of the fees and fines going on through the game. It's not in the rules, though. It's a house rule, and it's kind of a bad one. I know it's fun to win the free money, but the end game condition in Monopoly is people running out of money. Introduce a new revenue source. You add money into the game. It makes it last longer. It's not something Monopoly needs. By the way, I poked around online for some info. A 1991 computer game version let you set the free parking bonus anywhere from zero up to $65,000. It's a lot of money in Monopoly terms. The high cost of free parking, this is Central Time.